So we shall get underway. Bhagavi was not able to join us in person, unfortunately, because of some flights and other things, but she's going to Skype in from Pune in India, and hopefully we'll get a good message from her and she'll be able to join the panel discussion. My name is Piers Gooding. I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the Melbourne Social Equity Institute and the Disability Research Initiative. And before I begin, I'd like to do a welcome to. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Wiradjuri people of the Kulin Nation. And I'd like to pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. So, according to the United Nations, almost 60% of the world's 650 million people with disabilities live in the Asia Pacific. This translates to some 400 million people, among which we could reasonably assume that those with mental health issues or psychosocial disabilities number in the millions and perhaps tens of millions. Now, I don't need to talk about the legal barriers to good lives that this cohort face. I'm sure that'll come out in the presentations. But what I do want to emphasise before we begin are the regional solutions that are being sought to the kinds of barriers that people with disabilities face in this region. And a key driver to this cooperation is undoubtedly the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Now, the convention has been ratified by over 160 countries internationally and by 70% of countries in the Asia Pacific here. So that demonstrates strong global support and increasing regional support for human rights for people with disabilities. But of course, lacking a regional human rights mechanism like the European Convention of Human Rights, it's a little bit more difficult to coordinate in this region. But nonetheless, the convention has provided a very useful roadmap for a number of advocates to collaborate. And 2016 has been quite an important year for building regional alliances in the Asia Pacific. The UN this year incorporated disability and mental health issues into its Sustainable Development Goals for the 2030 Agenda, which is an important instrument for this region. The UN General Assembly President Morgans Liketoft, upon introducing the goals, commented that finally now, thanks to the advocacy of disability organisations and the concerted efforts of many others, people with disabilities have been included at the heart of the 2030 Development Agenda. So Australia, as a high-income country, has an important role to play in regional activity, both at the government and non-government level. The Australian Federation of Disabled Peoples Organisations is the current Asia-Pacific Chair of Disabled Peoples International, which represents organisations in over 130 countries. Now, unfortunately, I have to report that the Disabled Peoples International Executive Member, Trevor Carroll, will not be able to join us tonight for medical reasons, and I'd like to pass on his apologies. Other non-government organisations, like CBM, of which we're lucky to have a representative, Alicia Carroll, have played a significant role in supporting disabled people's organisations across the region. And at the government level, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has developed an $18 million program of disability-inclusive development to support foreign disabled people's organisations, and particularly here in the Indo-Pacific. The DFAT program recently at the Council of States Parties to the UN Convention was put forward as best practice by a number of other Council of States, a number of other states parties. And the DFAT program explicitly uses a rights-based framework for its work and seeks to empower disabled people's organisations within countries across the Indo-Pacific so that they can advocate for their own concerns. And here at the university, we have a number of academics engaged in research to promote this regional solution, or to promote regional solutions, including at the Nossal Institute. And of course, we're very pleased to have Associate Professor Harry Minnis here tonight, who I'll introduce shortly, who has been collaborating with leaders across the Asia Pacific for many years now. Outside Australia, a number of trans-Asian disability networks are also emerging. And Bhagavi's presentation will make that clear. And hopefully we'll hear from her a little bit more as well. I'm just going to try to Skype her in. We'll see if we can't get her on so she can hear the introduction. Hi, Bhargavi.
Hi, Chris.
I'm just doing the introduction and everyone's here, and we're just about to put your presentation on. Before we do get underway, I'd like to acknowledge the work of our admin staff in bringing this event together, and particularly Cassie Chen and Gary Dixon here. I'd also like to acknowledge the support of the Melbourne Law School and the Hallmark Disability Research Initiative and the Melbourne Social Equity Institute. Dr. Anna Arstein-Kerslake, who's the academic convener of the Disability Research Initiative, was particularly supportive when we were organising this event many months ago. Both the Disability Research Initiative and the Melbourne Social Equity Institute very much operate under something that you might call knowledge in action, where they very much seek to engage with community and even have community-led research. So we're really pleased to have people here tonight who are interested in this and some of those who are very active in the field. Tonight is our inaugural seminar on disability, mental health and human rights in this run of seminars, and we hope to have many more. And I think we've assembled a really terrific panel to explore these issues, and without further ado, I'd like to introduce the first speaker, Bhargavi, who has organised a video for us all to tell us a little bit about her work. Dr. Deva is the founder of the Bapu Trust for Research on Mind and Discourse and director of its research arm, the Centre for Advocacy in Mental Health in Pune, India. Dr. Deva convenes a trans-Asia network of people with psychosocial disability called Transforming Communities for Inclusion Asia. She's currently a facilitator of the International Disability Association and International Disability and Development Consortium Bridge course, which builds the capacity of disabled people's organisations to apply the convention to development in their context. Without further ado, we'll put on her presentation.
Moving out of India and looking at countries in the Asia region and
perhaps in Africa and other developing countries, is actually liberating from the point of view of policy making for community-based inclusion services. Being tied to the Hong Kong Development Mission, India faces a peculiar post-colonial situation. It's probably true of all Commonwealth nations in the world, which are struggling with the formations and reformations of the old asylum laws inherited from an Anglo-Saxon tradition. So I would like to kind of focus first on the Indian situation and talk about how time is divided for mental health policy in India. There is a mid-body time, pre-mid-body time, and a post-mid-body time. Pre-mid-body time, mid-body is an incident which happened in Chennai in 2001, where a number of people perished in a raging fire. They were deemed to be mentally ill. They had been kept tied down to beds or trees or other things in which you can die, of course.
Are witness to women being deprived of liberty and then
their property is taken away, women being deprived of liberty in an institution, particularly a private institution, and they have lost their chance at holding custody of their children. They are getting more easily divorced, and so on and so forth. So this nexus of laws has created really a disempowering situation for women. And it is a moot question whether such women are really mentally ill or not. The courts never had a way of figuring out who is really mentally ill and who is not. And for that matter, psychiatric care today does not have, any kind of test or any kind of X-ray or blood analysis or urine analysis or MRI, CT scan, what have you. There is no way by which this can be credibly established. That a person, whether a person has depression, schizophrenia, whatever. So there are those difficulties at the very foundation of the mental health sciences. And this only plays up in full measure when such matters as inheritance and particularly marriage and marital laws, marital rights, when they go before the court under a plea of insanity of the woman. Needless to say, this results in the negation of all the gains that have been obtained from other conventions such as CEDAW and the CRC. So even though a woman may be more empowered through the women's movement and the various domestic policies which exist today, under, say, the Domestic Violence Act and so on, when it actually plays with these mental health laws and the huge basket of incapacity laws, those rights can actually be negated or compromised. Or at the best, it can become a play of different jurisprudence before domestic court. So making it extremely stressful and traumatic for the women concerned. Some women we know have to fight in court for like almost a decade before they were able to establish a right. For example, over custody of their child or maintenance or holding on to share in their property. But many women do not receive justice. So this is typically a post-colonial situation. I suspect that it is true for a number of Commonwealth nations. And for sure, it is true for many countries to promote which have mental health institutions. So unsoundness of mind as a concept may have left several parts of the world. They continue to exist in many other Commonwealth nations. Even concepts like lunacy are used to increase your education. So that's about India, and I want to lead you off with sharing a little bit about my travels in Asia, the transforming ways for inclusion in Asia. And it's been a huge learning for us that there are about half the world does not have mental health laws, they don't have mental institutions. People are not forcibly conscripted. There are not that many institutions, or there are no institutions where people can be forcibly incarcerated. The whole mindset about violence, dangerousness, safety of self-interest, the need for seclusion, the need to make bodies, the state of bodies of property, or some people are considered to be lunatics. These kinds of things do not exist in about half the world. These are going from countries. For example, Nepal was never colonized, and therefore they don't have these assumptions. So like this, there are many countries where these assumptions have not existed, but they may in the future, as these countries look upon the Northwest and some countries like India and high income countries like Japan as role models and start to emulate our ways of life. As I travel through these countries, it became more and more evident that what people are asking for are very basic services. They don't have to go through a deinstitutionalization process in order to start community-based work, grassroots work on inclusion. Already the state is key, and they can come up with policies and programs which lay out the rich picture about doing direct work in communities. That brings a kind of a message of hope for all of us. There are many although we hope that we will for sure be able to negotiate with many groups.
So hopefully we can briefly video call Bhargavi and maybe give her an applause. Bhargavi, we just listened to your presentation and everyone would like to give you some applause. But Pat, is there anything else you would like to briefly add before we go on to the next speaker?
I'm fine, actually. I'd love to hear some questions. I know there are limits of time, so I don't want to impose on that.
Might come back to the questions at the end. Ben's going to be chairing a panel discussion, so we might come back to a question then. Would it be okay if we called you back then?
Yeah, for sure. I know that there is a sound issue, so that's quite okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the alternative is you could mute at your end and listen in as we all speak.
Ah, okay, so let me try doing that.
Okay, so without further ado, we should perhaps move to the next speaker. So, Associate Professor Harry Minnis is head of the Global and Cultural Mental Health Unit here in the Centre of Mental Health at the University of Melbourne. Although he'll talk tonight about his work with Indonesian policymakers, I should also add that Harry has a slew of titles, including Director of the Victorian Transcultural Psychiatric Unit, the Co-Director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Centre on Research and Training in Mental Health and Substance Abuse, the Head of Secretariat Movement for Global Mental Health, Member for Ministers' Council on Asylum Seekers and Detention, and a member of the WHO Director General's International Expert Panel on Mental Health and Substance Abuse. So would you all please put your hands together and welcome Harry.
Thanks very much, Piers. Hi, Bhargavi. I can't hear you, but you may be able to hear me. We saw each other in Leicester just 2 or 3 months ago. It's good to see you again. I will run through very quickly what I thought I would do when Piers asked me to do this presentation. Rather than talking in general about mental health and human rights in the Asia-Pacific, give an example of what I think has been a fairly effective human rights intervention in Indonesia. So I'll move through that fairly quickly and try to make some general points from it. The first point to make is that there are tens of instruments that talk about mental health and human rights. They start, of course, with Universal Declaration and the Convent and the Covenants. They didn't specifically talk about mental health and human rights, but are the basis for many of the rest of the instruments. And, of course, the most important is the Convention, the 2007 Convention. As Piers mentioned, most countries have signed on, many have ratified, and I think probably no convention has been signed and ratified faster than CRPD, which has been quite remarkable. And countries that we tend to think of as having lots of human rights problems have also been quite quick, like Vietnam ratified the convention with no reservations. China has ratified the convention and so on. And just in a couple of months, 3 or 4 months ago, the UN Human Rights Council issued a statement on mental health and human rights with a particular focus on human rights in institutions of various kinds. The High Commissioner has been called on to issue to make a report and then for further action to be taken. So it's a good time to be actually talking about and thinking about how we can deal with mental health and human rights more effectively than we have done in the past. Clearly there have been major failures of human rights protection. And these are failures both in terms of negative rights, you know, the right to be kind of left alone and not tied up and not to have one's liberty constrained, the ICCPR sort of rights. And there are massive problems in the economic, social, and cultural rights arena, which is, you know, the first is right not to be bothered, the second is rights to various things, essentially. So a failure to invest, a failure to develop effective mental health programs, a failure to develop effective community-level protections are among the most important failures. And general stigma and discrimination in just about every areas of life. for people with mental disorders is probably the daily experience of people with mental disorders, not only in low and middle income countries, but in our own country as well. The issue that I want to talk about is illegal restraint and confinement in the community. So this is a little bit the other side of what Bhargavi was talking about, who was talking very much about mental health institutions, psychiatric hospitals and so on. What I want to talk about is restraint and confinement of people with mental disorders, essentially by families and local communities, people who are thought to have a severe mental disorder, and for a variety of reasons that we can discuss if we have time later on, the only option which is left to the family or to the local community is to restrain people. In Indonesia, this practice is known as pasung, and it refers to physical restraint or confinement of, quote, criminals, crazy and dangerously aggressive people. And, you know, criminal behaviour and being dangerously aggressive is conflated very often with a sense that somebody is crazy or a judgment that somebody has a serious mental illness. So these are some of the methods, with restraint in stocks, being locked up in sheds in the paddy field, being put in a box. This young man was a young man with schizophrenia who had basically lived in this box apart from getting out for toilet and feeding for many years. So he was found during our work in Aceh in Indonesia. A young man with schizophrenia, we have permission for the use of this photo. In 2005, when we started working in Aceh following the tsunami. And when we looked at a relatively large number of people who had been restrained in this way, the mean time of restraint was 4.5 years. Some people had been restrained in this way for more than 20 years. And based on our work in Aceh, we estimated a number of years ago that the number of people in this form of restraint in Indonesia is probably about 60,000 people. Now, the Ministry of Health itself made an estimate based on the National Health Survey, which they do every five years or so, at 57,000 people. So it's a very large number. It's worth thinking a little bit about the component of rights when we talk about human rights. So we know that, you know, in order to think about how human rights operates, there is a rights holder, the subject of the right, in this case a person with mental illness in pasung, who has a claim to something, in this case a right to liberty and a right to many other things, which the person might assert against some individual or group. Usually that means government, because government is the main duty bearer, while citing in support of his or her claim a ground. And the grounds are many, including local laws and now, most importantly, CRPD and everything that comes from CRPD. But in order for people to exercise their rights, they need to know that they have those rights. They need to have access to the things to which they have a right. For example, even minimal health services. They need to be able to effectively exercise the right, which means they need to know how to exercise the right. They need to have the resources to do so, and very often need very substantial support in order to be able to effectively exercise rights. And the duty bearer needs to respond appropriately. So the government needs to both do something about issues like illegal restraint and confinement and the positive things like providing the necessary services, supports and so on. So, in 2008 we formed this little research group. This was during a period. It's interesting that there are these kinds of carvings that you can find in Indonesia which show a person in stocks. So this is something which is very widespread. And it has to be said that this is not just in Indonesia. This form of restraint in the community exists throughout Africa, throughout Asia, China, Vietnam. Following Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, many people were found in cages, in stocks, in all sorts of terrible circumstances when when people were evacuated and they were just left behind. And in places like Thailand and so on and so on, so all over the place. This is not just Indonesia. In 2009, as a result of effective advocacy by people working on developing mental health services in Aceh, the provincial government of Aceh made an active decision that they would eliminate this practice from the province of Aceh. The initial goal was to eliminate the practice by 2011. That was a very ambitious goal. It's taken a much longer time, but it has effectively been achieved in Aceh. And the program that was developed in Aceh is now being implemented in a variety of ways in more than 20 provinces in Indonesia, and that number grows over time. In 2010, the Minister of Health announced the national program to eliminate Pasung from the whole of the country. Now, the Minister of Health was like the provincial government of Aceh, a bit ambitious. She said this would be done by 2014. That was an impossible goal to achieve. And in 2016, the Minister of Social Affairs, in February 2016, the Minister of Social Affairs joined Ministry of Health in recognition of the fact that health can't do everything that needs to be done in order to deal with this problem. Social affairs is absolutely critical in order to deal with it. And in any case, social affairs is the line ministry which is responsible for implementing CRPD. So there is a framework in it. This is going back to Aceh. This is the governor of Aceh in 2010 at a press conference releasing a person from stocks and basically handing him over to the health the health professionals in order to provide treatment and rehabilitation. And the treatment includes not only psychiatric and mental health treatment and rehabilitation, but very often it requires physical rehabilitation because people have been restrained and immobile for very long times. And it happened that the director of the mental hospital in Aceh at the time was actually a physiotherapist. And so he built an extra ward and a whole lot of things happened and the program went ahead. There is quite an effective framework for human rights for people with mental disorders in Indonesia. As I've already mentioned, 2009, 2010. It's now in 2016, more 25 of the 34 provinces have established this program. CRPD was ratified by the Indonesian government in 2011. The mental health law was enacted in 2014. That there are some aspects of the mental health law that are problematic in that they're not compliant, they're not well aligned with CRPD. In 2015, a presidential decree on a national human rights action plan, and hopefully the increased involvement of the National Human Rights Commission, Komnas Ham. 2010, as I've already mentioned, the Minister for Health, and in 2016, just a month or two ago, the National Disability Law was passed by the Indonesian Parliament. So you can see that over a relatively short time, not much more than 5 or 6 years, really a fairly comprehensive legal and policy framework has been established in order to more effectively deal with some of the human rights abuses. When we last looked, more than 10,000 people had been released and freed from these kinds of restraints, receiving treatment and rehabilitation. This is of variable quality. We don't really know whether it's sufficient for people to remain out of restraint, because it's quite common for people to be taken to hospital, to be out of restraint, to go back. There are no services available in the community, so the family reapplies. Either they rechain or put in stocks or whatever. Now, the basis for our program, together with Ministry of Health and Ministry of Social Affairs, is the International Mental Health Leadership Program, which we've been running for 15 years now. We have more than 120 people from Indonesia who have been part of this intensive training program. and they include the current and former director of mental health, heads of relevant sections in a variety of places, and key leaders in academic and in service organisations, but also in a number of disabled persons organisations from different parts of the country. And we've also trained to get our Indonesian colleagues with our involvement have also trained several hundred people in Indonesia in issues of mental health and human rights. This is just a list of programs, research, education, training programs that have been funded by DFAT, all focused on Indonesia amongst the other programs that we've run. And you can see from this that the focus on mental health and disability has been a strong focus for quite a number of years. So we were involved, for example, in 2009 in helping to establish and support the first major national disabled persons organisation for people with mental illness in Indonesia. Since then, groups that have participated in the program have developed an evaluation plan for the national Indonesia Free from Pasung program. Again, in 2016, we'll be focusing on, given that the framework now is established, how can the process be accelerated? The kind of conceptual framework that's guided what we do is based on Amartya Sen's notion of development as freedom. And we think that notion applies really quite directly to thinking about mental health as freedom. So with freedom being both the underpinning for any kinds of interventions and also the outcome of effective interventions, leading to enhanced capabilities of a variety of kinds. So any mental health program that is going to be worthwhile, in my view, is going to be promoting freedom from those things that impair capabilities and strengthening the freedom of people with mental disorders to be fully involved in decision making, to access health and social services, participate in social life, and to fully exercise their rights and liberties. What I want to finish on, and I just want to say this as maybe a basis for some discussion, is that there is a real problem which is brewing very actively around Article 12 and around the general comment on Article 12. There is a kind of a divide which is developing between formal psychiatry and the disability rights movement, and this problem has got to be solved, because there is a real danger that rather than working together, that the mental health movement and the disability movement are going to be at loggerheads, and I think this will damage both sides. This is at the launch by the Minister of Social Affairs of the latest addition to the national program to deal with this human rights issue. Thanks.
Very much, Associate Professor Minnis. Very much appreciate that. And I think that last point about the political nature of some of these discussions is really important. I mean, I think to pretend that mental health law and policy is not a political matter is a pitfall that often happens in these debates. And certainly there have been a number of events on mental health and human rights in recent weeks, even here in Victoria, which tries to explore some bridges over the divide which you mentioned. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce the panel members and invite Harry and indeed Pargavi, if we can get it organised, to engage in a panel discussion. To introduce the panel, I'd like to welcome Ben Rinaldo to the podium. Ben is employed at Wellways Australia in a designated peer lived experience worker role, working to support people's empowerments to take an active leadership role in organisational change, community education and awareness and personal recovery objectives. Bhagavi will try to angle the microphone towards the panel, and after introducing the others and hearing from Anne and Alicia, we'll certainly invite you to join the discussion. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Piers, for that introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks to Bhagavi and Professor Harry Minnis for their presentations. I'd like to introduce the panel. Of the panel members, we have Anne Kuniawan from the Ministry of Health in Indonesia. He's been working in the area of mental health and disability at the Center of Humanity and Health Policy. He's been involved in various projects, including projects related to community-based rehabilitation and accessible primary health care for people with a disability. And we have Alicia Carroll, who is a Disability Inclusion Advisor in the Inclusive Development Department at CBM Australia. She currently works on a number of development programs and research projects in Africa, Asia and the Pacific with government and NGOs towards inclusion of people with disability. I'd like you to come take a seat. So we have some time now to reflect on the presentation and respond to the talks. And hopefully we'll have some time for questions and discussion towards the end. But I'd just like to hear your reflections on the presentations and a sense of what the most important key issues are. We've heard some confronting issues and topics presented. And challenges around laws that actually serve to further deprive people of civil and political liberties and the impact on women in India, and issues around restraint and confinement in Indonesia and some of the positive steps being taken towards eradicating and eliminating these types of practices. And I was interested to hear about the challenge of knowing and exercising your rights and some of the effective advocacy being taken at grassroots level from DPOs through to government officials. So I'll let you guys respond.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I work for Ministry of Health and Disability. I think most of the key points about mental health and disability, human and in terms of human rights issues, which I just brought up by Professor Harry before. But I would like to share you a bit of story from my previous research that I was involved in. So the research was about the mental health community, mental health rehabilitation in a small village in Ponorogo. The village is actually like, if you go there by plane, it would be like, take you like 9 hours by car to get to the village, which is, and that is the only way to get there. So, there in that village, I saw, I met this old lady who lived by herself, and she lives in a very poor condition. It's a very old house, and she has to support like herself. So she lives with her son, 45-year-old. His name, let's call it Supriyato. But and he has been chained in the back of his yard for 30 years. So the chain is actually holding him in barely like. Through the wall, and like there was a door, I think like 100 kilogram stone holding it, because so he couldn't, anyway. So he did what Harry told you is it like he did most of the thing there, like from eating and also doing the toilet and everything in the area. This lady has tried to get a treatment for Supriyanto to get him better. But so he tried to the from a religious treatment to shaman healing, and also the accessing the drug from the community health service available in the village. But obviously all of them are already in the book, but the most interesting part when she tried to access the drugs from the community health services, she also has a problem in accessing it. Like she, either the drugs was unavailable, or sometimes she also has a problem with because the new system of the health insurance didn't recognize for accessing the mental drugs. So that was the only option for her to treat Supriyanto, because other if she didn't treat her that way, there was one experience where Supriyanto tried to attack the neighbors and also try to hurt himself. And the other story is about a cultural myth about mental health issues in Indonesia. The story is about pulung gantung. Pulung is lights coming up to the sides, like pulang spa, and gantung is hanging. So this is a big case that is happening in Yogyakarta, in the central Java. There is a myth in that village, if a person in that village saw a fallen star, people believe that the next day there will be a people found dead by hanging in the village. And there is a big number of cases with suicide in this area. So concerning about this, actually, speaking about mental health and issues in Indonesia is a complexity of many problems. So lack of policy support, like health services, inaccessibility of health services, social support, and also a cultural beliefs about what is known to be a mental illness is an issue that a lot of talk about. There are laws and action that's been passed in Indonesia, like what Professor Harry already mentioned before, but from the research from University of Indonesia, I found that there are 716 direct and indirect laws concerning mental health and disability in Indonesia, and at least 8 provinces and districts have involved in mental health and disability in their laws. The problem is lack of coordination and lack of leadership. Most of the time, it's clashing to each other, like who is in whose authority in working what, and resulted in a further issue. And the mental health law has been passed in 2014, and the disability pass is also disability law is also just passed in 2016, like this March. So we are expecting a change in Indonesia towards a better condition for people with mental illness and disability.
Thank you. It's great to hear that there's developments of new laws that are upholding and promoting the rights of people with disability. What I'm hearing is that there's still a fair way to go with social and attitudinal change in regards to stigma and discrimination and exclusion of people with mental illness. I'd like to hear from Alicia as well.
Thank you. So my name's Alicia. I'm from an international development organisation called CBM. We focus on supporting disability-focused programs overseas, but we also work with other organisations that are working in development to help them to include people with disabilities in their development programs. So we work with governments, we work with international organisations and civil society organisations, and we do this in collaboration with disabled people's organisations. I guess some of the discussion around disability in development has come about through a shift in development generally towards a human rights based approach. So most development organisations now have a commitment to a human rights based approach to the way they do development to ensure that the most marginalised people are reached in their programs. And this has really created a space for us to talk about disability as a human rights issue. And over the last 10 years, we've seen a real really positive outcomes in how organisations understand disability from a human rights perspective. We saw the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities ratified by, or continuing to be ratified by many countries now. And I guess too, the Australian aid program has also been somewhat of a leader internationally in requiring the organisations it funds overseas to demonstrate how they're doing disability inclusion in their programs. And as Piers mentioned, has directly supported disabled people's organisations in the region to participate in that process, because we know that a core aspect of the convention is to have people with disabilities at the heart of issues that affect them. In terms of how we're supporting organisations to understand and grapple with the intersections between disability, mental health, and human rights, I guess we've seen a lot of improvements in other areas of including people with disabilities, but perhaps the area of including people with psychosocial disability has been less so. So it's a tricky space to negotiate, and part of the reason for that has been also that disabled people's organisations often don't include people with psychosocial disability. And these organisations are often the way that people learn about their human rights. It's the avenue through which they learn, and it's also the way that they can feed back to governments and civil society about what their needs and rights would look like in their particular context. So part of our what we would like to see more of is that disabled people's organisations, whether they're cross-impairment, so umbrella-type organisations, or those that specifically focus on the rights of people with psychosocial disability, are supported to grow and have a voice in their particular context. And that's where Mugabe's organisation, TCI Asia, becomes really, really important. Not only having a voice in an international space, but also providing, a linkage between people with psychosocial disability in different countries across Asia and the Pacific, to start to share what is happening in their context and share ideas. I think listening to both Harry and Bhagavi's talks, it's a lot about the huge human rights violations of people with psychosocial disability in terms of confinement, literal confinement, and prevention of participation in their community, both in institutions and also in the community. And so one of the areas of contention, as Harry mentioned, is around how this confinement of people with disabilities can take different forms. So we don't want to encourage confinement in hospitals, and we don't want to encourage confinement in communities. So the emphasis, therefore, becomes on, I guess, Article 19 of the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which focuses on what do we need to do to help communities to include people with psychosocial disabilities in every part of their community as well. So, and I guess one of the main issues around that is how do we build on what might already be happening. Local initiatives to inclusion that takes very different forms in different contexts, and building up on those strengths. And then how can we also make sure that we're not creating legislative frameworks that actually undermine people with disabilities' ability to speak out? So there are some of the issues that I threw out with it. I'm sure there's lots of questions.
Yeah. Thanks, Anne. Thanks, Alicia. And we might have time for a few questions for the speakers and the panel members.
Yeah, Bhagavi might also have some reflections that she might want to add. She can't come for drinks or dinner afterwards. to get her input.
Is she still on mute?
Yeah, I think she's muted.
Yes, okay, still on mute. I think so, but I may have missed a little bit of the conversations because I did not hear everyone very clearly. Particularly Alicia didn't hear you very well. So just to kind of add a few stray thoughts that came in while listening to different people, I really enjoyed everyone having us. Thanks a lot. Nice to meet you online. Hope to meet you again sometime soon. I really enjoyed your presentation, and kind of the last, actually the last question that you left us off with on Article 12 and the kind of divide that exists between the professionals and the disability movement activists. It set me thinking, and particularly in the context of the Asian region, which is diverse in many ways, including in terms of policy formations for the mental health sector. So I had a few thoughts on that, actually the bridge may be not, the bridge is forming very strongly, and everybody is concerned, and everybody is moving towards consensus, towards imagining new formulations, to imagining new strategies. And I was just coming back from a big conference in Chennai where different people had come, including the you know, the Trieste people and lots of international speakers, and it seems that we're all moving in good synergy, and I think it's important to celebrate that movement. In fact, we heard from a number of professionals, as you said also, Harry, that freedom first is a slogan that came up from Chennai, and so everyone is realizing that there is a need to imagine new ways of working in the mental health sector. So that's one thought that I had. I also want to say that from the Asian region, there are not many places with the legal incapacity laws or the mental health laws. There are many countries which do not have mental health laws. I think the challenge for those countries is actually to decide even whether they need a mental health law, or can they go with a general health law, health rights law, or a disability rights law. So those are decisions that different user survival groups, disabled people's groups are making within some countries, for example in Nepal. And I don't think that legal solutions have to be in one direction. And I think we should be open to the possibility that different kinds of rights can come from different kinds of spaces. And it's important to hold on to what you said, Harry, that we should make sure that we do not create more barriers for the full and effective participation of people with psychosocial disabilities. Finally, I want to say that there is a huge need. You know, medical rehabilitation is great, and to have actually a physiotherapist or health professionals on board makes it a bit more comprehensive in terms of, you know, addressing really people who've been in restraint for a number of years. It's really heartwarming to know that all these efforts are going on in Indonesia. But I think it's also important to stop this another kind of revolving door set up between cages and families and communities, to look at non-formal caregivers trainings, to look at what are the different kinds of things that needs to come in as training and grassroots implementation in terms of realizing the full vision and potential of Article 19 of the Women's CRPD. Here we do a lot of trainings for families, for people in communities, and I think Article 19 is about all the stakeholders, and we need to have something to offer, you know, which is inviting to all those stakeholders that yes, it's important to care for each other and to care and support persons with disabilities in general and persons with psychosocial disabilities. So I think so that I would like to kind of offer as a disability activist, as someone who's worked in the sector with very strong conviction on freedom first, very strong conviction that you know, we need to look beyond the old colonial type institutions, that there is a way forward, and Article 19 of the CRPD embodies that. And each of us bring our little bit of innovation, our little bit of imagination into what we all can do together. So So, yeah, thanks. This is, I leave off with these thoughts. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bhagavi. Well, we've come towards the end of our time together. Time's escaped us. Would you give a round of applause to our guest speakers and the panel members?
And many thanks to Ben for chairing the event. Drinks afterwards. They might go. Unfortunately, you can't join us, Bhagavi, but everyone's welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pierce and Ben, for having me over. Nice meeting all the friends.
Oh, here's the. You can see the audience just before you go. There are actually people in this room. It's not just us.
Okay. Thank you so much for that.
Goodbye, Bhagavi.
Bye.
Thanks so much.
That's all right.
Sorry it wasn't.
Sorry.